First Annual Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-11, Establishing a Polio Clinic and Exercise Protocol, Research Implications. Presenters, Richard Owen, Mylon Knapp, E. Larson.
And welcome to the final session. I have not heard for sure that Mr. Roosevelt arrived. I'm assuming that he is here and perhaps will show up imminently. But in the meantime, I think we ought to go ahead with the scientific session as planned. We do have a full morning and we're planning to complete the session at 11:30, so those of you who need to get the bus to Atlanta can get going. There will be three presenters in the first hour. The first presenter is Richard Owen, Dr. Owen, who is medical director of Sister Kenny Institute, who will be discussing the establishment of a polio clinic and research implications. Dr. Owen.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Laurel. Is my microphone working? Okay. This is the type of a meeting that I wish I could write my paper after instead of before, because I'd like to change some of the names that I attached to the various aspects of the late onset of extra problems in people who had polio. And I talked to Fred Maynard about the problem of what in the world we call old polios, and the number of ways I said that in large number of words was awkward. I, like many of you, attended the first meeting in Chicago, the first international meeting on respiratory rehabilitation and the polio survived, whatever happened to old polios. I forget the exact name of it. I have it in my article, but Laura told me not to read anything and talk fast. You didn't talk that? You didn't say that?
You can read whatever you like.
Okay.
I can do without a light, though, so you can hear a little bit.
Well, we're trying to get a vote.
I can do without a light because, as you'll see, part of this has been done in the dark, just as this, some of the things we've been talking about. When I came back from the meeting in Chicago, it was obvious that we have an underinformed medical population, an underinformed patient population, and certainly an underinformed therapeutic interventionist population. And I was quite touched by that meeting, and you can imagine all the more so since I was one of the old polios. And I found a poem by Walter Polk, and I found out from my good friend now, Dr. Bernard Tomlinson, that he's never heard of Walter Pope, who's a 17th century English poet and a physician. And it's nice to have a short attention span and be distracted by what's going on around you. I admire you, David, because you handled it so well. And the light doesn't seem to go on. Nevertheless, Walter Pope had this to say: "Let us govern our passions with absolute sway, to grow better and wiser as strength wears away, not by gout nor by stone, but a gentle decay." And of course, I had a whole audience of old polios, plus my wife, in tears over that one, because it was really a pretty great way to start a meeting. And the message was really a little garbled that I was presenting, because I really wasn't quite sure what it was we were all facing and whether or not this was a number of different problems that were lumped together, whether it was one problem with a variety of expressions, or whether there were so many multiple interacting factors coming to bear on a single individual who happened to have had polio 30 to 50 years ago. One of the neat persons in my study is a lady who's the 79-year-old, I think, at the end of Laurel's spectrum, who came with, is it 79? Is that your oldest reporting person? But this lady, we had Laurel's survey handed out to all our patients. This 79-year-old lady came into my office complaining of the problems of polio aging, and she took off these braces made about 30 years ago, which is a point that Ruben made, that many of the braces are date back to antiquity. This lady had two braces that weighed 12 pounds between them, and I could barely move them off the table to make room for her to clamber up on our table, which in the style of the English is high and awkward to get onto. So I don't mean that the English are high and awkward to get onto, but their tables are. Nevertheless, when I woke up in the middle of the night concerned about what I was going to say, I realized that what I was struggling with was Jerry Herbison's rats and the fact that his rats could run a 4:45 mile and would finish the Boston Marathon in the top 20 rats, top 20 people. And so that so disturbed me that I couldn't get back to sleep. And so, well, were you worried about the rats too? Well, I don't want to worry about your problems. But at any rate, I settled that issue, wondering still about how fast and far rats can run, and then got back to my subject. And I realized that I came to a point that took me 326 steps to get to. And I realized that after four times up and down the 88 steps that lead from my motel room to the level of the dining room, that I had been an example or an experimental creature in this problem of growing old with polio. And I found an interesting thing. The fourth time I went up, I was better off than the first time. And now that seems hard to understand in a way, except it fits some of the things that I postulate and I hope to show with some of my clinic experience that I'm not reporting on today, because Laura told me only to report on my polio clinic, how we established it, and what our protocol is. But I do think that part of the problem in polio is that we lose function from not using function. And as a consequence of that, a muscle will decay to its lowest level of stimulation. And in some cases, regardless of what the average muscle tester might think, many people can get by without a good quadriceps, without a fair quadriceps, and go through life unless they have to go out to the ballpark and go down a ramp. So, the other thing I found was that I had a myofascial pain syndrome of polio. Ernie pointed that out to me because he squeezed my shoulder muscles and he proved that I was in pain. And he said that that was an example of myofascial pain. And see, and I'm not sure whether that was an example of myofascial pain on my part or the eliciting of tenderness on his part. And this is one of our problems that I think we face, is the problem of nomenclature. And whether or not I'm talking about somebody who's getting old gracefully and giving up muscle function by their choice, or whether it's somebody who has a progressive spinal muscular atrophy, which I think may be a different disease, and which might be progressive spinal muscular atrophy in an individual who is predisposed to that on an hereditary basis or some other marvelous thing attached to the HLA, some of those things, which I know there's some scientists in the room that can talk about that, so I'll leave it. That's one of the nice things about this meeting. We can always leave a subject. Would you turn on the slide projector, Dr. Herbison of Philadelphia? That merely tells me what Lauro told me to talk about. He also wanted me to put in my exercise protocol, so I put it in. I want to start off by saying something, though. Jacqueline Perry, who I admire very much and have for some time, had the impression from some early meetings that I attended that I was some sort of an exercise nut. And although I personally enjoy physical movement and using my body, I despise therapeutic exercise for my own person. And if I opted to, I would not do it at all. So that's one of the things I think is the nature of the human being that comes into play when we're talking about who wants to do this exercise that we're talking about. So as much as I'm an exercise nut, what I like to do is offer the person the possibility of exercise and offer it in a careful, well-described fashion and set the limits that Jerry puts on the patients. And here I'm finding out that we're in some agreement, which is a nice position to be in. So to start with, what we do first, we gather some clinical data. And one is the patient survey. We use a very awkward thing that I constructed, again, in the middle of the night when I wasn't worrying about how fast rats run. I was worrying about a survey a few nights before our first polio conference. And I made a marvelous instrument that I didn't have put together by a statistician or a biometrician. And as a consequence, I confused myself a great deal by my data. But my data is best I can tell, and I'm not subjecting it to anybody's critical review, is quite comparable to everybody else's. 80% of our patients reporting on the survey thought they were getting weaker. 50% thought they had pain in their neck and shoulders. 40% had pain that nobody could actually describe to them to their satisfaction. But when you think about your average patient population, that's about it anyway. Because my slide maker wanted me to put only 8 items on a slide, he had me divide history into 3 parts. And it was sort of nice that he had me do that because, although I wasn't thinking of it, it made me think about how I would divide it if I were forced to. And since I was, I did it. And as I indicated, the vast majority of our patients had a progression of weakness, and that and on the other hand, the majority of the people we surveyed were people that had come to our conference with expressed concerns or in response to some of the information in the Rehab Gazette or in the newspapers and on the TV show that Armin talked about. I forget the name of that program. The odd thing was, in our group, we've only had 3 people on ventilators attending our conferences. But you have to remember, we're in Minnesota. It's our first meeting was in February, and the next meeting was on a lovely day in June, where Minnesotans would rather go out and enjoy the lakes than listen to a talk. And the next one was in October, a lovely day, and I think I would have been happy to be out enjoying the leaves. So I'm not sure why we aren't seeing the ventilator patients. This is something we hope to find out more about as Dr. Knapp works on his study to track down the patients of the epidemic year 1952 treated by the medical staff of Sister Kenny Institute. I wanted to find out the experience of pain, and many of our patients reported a vague pain that they associated with substantial fatigue. And this easy fatigability was a common occurrence, and it was associated with a pain-like syndrome if I elicited from them that it was painful. Now, I'm not sure whether this is part of the pain that is reported by others. These are the people that actually have come to our clinic. I should give you some numbers. I apologize for not doing that at the beginning, but I was so distracted by the speed of rats that I lost that. We had, at our first 3 polio conference, 188 individuals who had paralytic polio. We also made room for spouses and significant others, including my wife, who's an excellent observer of the passing scene, and so he had sort of a spy in the audience to report response, which I think is the fascinating thing about a group of people with a similar problem getting together at a meeting. It was a touching sort of an affair with a lot of shared experiences and a lot of people going home from that meeting content, which I think is one of the interesting aspects about, have I run out of time? One of the interesting aspects of this problem is that the lonesomeness that people feel when they're isolated with a problem that they feel nobody either knows about or cares about. And a lot of doctors don't know about it, and that's one of our responsibilities, to turn out a responsible piece of information for the medical professions in our own areas. If we do anything, we should go out and spread the word. It's nice to say that on a Sunday, I suppose, but at any rate, the experience of fatigue I talked about, overwork effect, I was very much interested in that because I was worried about that since 1955 and have been cautious all that time. I attended a meeting here, which interestingly enough was on April the 15th of 1955 when the Salk vaccine's successful utilization was reported and the Salk vaccine was freed up for use. So that was my at that meeting, Robert Bennett reported on the awesome effects of overwork, and yet in his article he reported on but four cases in 260 that he tracked down. In our cases, we had one person in our series who actually went from a functional quadriceps to a 2+ quadriceps with careful exercise, progressive resistive exercises. He gradually got back up to lifting 11 pounds. He felt good about that and leveled off and is on a maintenance program, which I believe in, and I believe that's a component of a recommendation I make to all of my patients. So overwork, and I think when I hear people say that a patient was put on exercise and the person overworked, it more often is that the person put themselves on an exercise program injudiciously, or went to the spa and were put on a Nautilus, and the Nautilus cranked out its energy and stunned this muscle. And where the overwork happens, I don't know. I have an idea, and I'll bring it up later when I talk about conditioning. Well, I tossed, since I had to divide the slide up, this is the related factors. How many of my patients had a confirmed new neurologic disease? We just had one lady who had confirmed multiple sclerosis. In the 126 patients I've seen in clinic, because polio was a very dignified disease after the life and career of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the people of Minnesota clambered to have that disease put on, that diagnosis put on their children. And I have had three people with developmental disabilities, cerebral palsy primarily, and I mean three people with cerebral palsy, one person with a childhood stroke from most likely related to infection, and we have two people with unknown neurologic diseases, the duration of which I'm not sure. But those people had not progressed, but they were just having funny feelings about having had polio. The need for additional ambulatory assistance is one of the loose things that we felt was something we should check on because it should be an indicator of progression. But in my patients and in my practice, the need for additional ambulatory assist is often something that I impose on the patient because I think too many of the people with residuals of polio are actually overworking in an ineffective, inefficient fashion, putting additional stress on musculoligamentous structures and the cardiopulmonary system. And as a consequence, I more often than not am inclined to encourage people to use a wheelchair for long distance ambulation and for conditioning, use a crutch or a cane for community ambulation, and use whatever they want to around the house where they're not putting themselves under stress. The common occurrence of fracture or musculoskeletal injury is such that I didn't even bother counting it for the purposes of this meeting, but I will report that. The complicating factor here is that many people with paralytic polio are employed. I think Dr. Codd indicated that something like 80% were employed of in this group. She studied it in Rochester. Now, I think that's been my experience. And they usually are employed, but they are at risk of falling in the workplace. And an injury, a workers' comp injury in the workplace, creates a terrible burden for the physician who has to figure out the quality of the pre-existent injury in somebody who says, gee, I was getting along fine until I fell in the workplace. And here you look at an individual who has such borderline motor function that you would have advised them to be in braces or something of that sort. So one of the dilemmas we face, I think, is defining this information sufficiently clearly so that our public agencies, the Social Security Administration, the Public Welfare Administration, and workers' comp and long-term disability insurers can understand what's up. I have 5 minutes left, so I'll go on. I skipped the effect of cold. I think we all, we sort of beat that thing yesterday. The sleep disturbances are an item that I think we should study in those people who are terribly troubled by pain, by attention disorders, and by waking in the night gasping for breath. And we, Armin was talking about his gradual development of a sleep laboratory in his center. And when that's available, it's a comfort to identify those people that do and don't have sleep disorders. Many of the people we saw gave up function, gave up activity prior to losing motor function. And so my feeling is that some people give up function, give up certain mobility and activities because of other related sociologic causes, and then take to reduced activity, then notice that they're getting weaker. Nobody in our group was doing any form of cardiopulmonary conditioning. None of the participants are wheelchair, that have been at my conferences, are wheelchair athletes. And it's interesting to me because I'm an examiner for the National Wheelchair Athletic Organization and the National Wheelchair Basketball Organization, and I'm a participant in wheelchair athletics. And I would have thought that if anything would have lured somebody to me with a problem, perhaps those factors would. But I must point out that I still feel that men are shy people that are likely to stay away from a center where they're going to learn bad news. And this might be what eschews the reporting on surveys. We don't have a gate lab. I wish we did, from the standpoint of assessing the cardiopulmonary status of the patient and their tolerance to work. Jackie Perry was very modest and not reported, and she didn't report on a man that we share information about who was in such awful cardiopulmonary condition that he was really walking on beyond his maximum capacity to ambulate, and his effect was that he was stressing himself beyond stress levels in his ambulation pattern. He should take to a wheelchair, perhaps, or should take to better bracing, but you know how people are. The additional studies, we don't do electromyographs on the patients that come to our polio clinic, and the main reason we don't is that they've all been done. And we, in Minneapolis, we have about 25 electromyographers. Only three or four of us have attended an Ernie Johnson course, and the one that would be best qualified to do electromyography on people with old polio is too busy running an old polio clinic. The exercise protocol I've broken down in the following fashion. This is one of the things that I want to make clear. Of the 126 patients we've seen with the residuals of polio reporting additional disability, only 57 have been in, have I had start a physical therapy program. The vast majority of them that I've seen and not seen in conjunction with my polio clinic that was started in October have, the vast majority were handled merely by my interventions in the office, teaching them how to do some simple stretching exercises, fixing up their braces, advising them to swim a little bit more, or patting them on the back and telling them good work, or offering them the option of exercise and having them say, gee, I'm awfully glad to hear about all of this, and I'm glad to know there's an option, and then leave comfortably. And I think that that's what we ought to offer, if anything, is the comfort of the person to decide what in the world they want to do. So I'll go on to my exercise protocol. One of the commonest things that we found is a tight heel cord buckling the knee, and that's in the person that walks with a free-swinging knee with weak or absent quadriceps. And I was pleased to hear that that was quite comparable to your findings, Jackie. We do prolonged stretching of the calf muscle by simply having the person lean into a wall, do that on a home program, and a lot of them get better. I've sent a couple for heel cord lengthenings. Flexibility. Sister Kenny was a strong person for stretching of the hamstring musculature, and most of our patients don't have tight hamstrings and are inclined to have some degree of weaker bottom. Trunk mobility exercises. A lot of the back problems associated with old polio are associated with lordosis, and they have some tightness in the back extensors. They oftentimes have trunk weakness that's not in relationship to their polio, but quite comparable to the type of trunk weakness that you see in the average sedentary human being. And so I start the individuals on reverse sit-ups, which I learned from watching Debbie Drake on the television. She was an exerciser who used to be on some morning show, and she did a reverse sit-up, which is sitting up, leaning back, holding, and coming forward. So in effect, it's like an isometric strengthening program, but it can be done in the absence of hip flexors, and it can be done without the lurching forward and throwing the trunk up in the air that is required of abdominal musculature otherwise. I was pleased to hear, I'm going to stumble over the pronunciation of Dr. Amiansson. I should be able to pronounce an Amiansson name coming from Minnesota, but I was pleased to hear what she was doing with the Cybex. The Cybex terrifies me, and here I am, a physician, and I'm prescribing it some. But we're using it for these old polios with a reason. One is to find out what the measurement of the quadriceps function is, to measure the strength decrement and measure comparison to the opposite side. And just as you said, Jackie, we're finding that the manual muscle test in the quadriceps suffers from a great deal of the unwillingness of the examiner to break the femur and or the patella, and also from the unwillingness of the patient to hold against possible pain. But we are finding that the people tolerate the Cybex test. We do that three times on a monthly basis after the first examination. We put some people on isokinetic exercises when they're available to the patient. Those are usually our younger patients. We use the modified PRE program that Dr. Feldman reported on, and I couldn't find anybody to take responsibility for that, and so I could name it. And I asked Walter Stoloff, and he said he thought it was Barbara De La Tour, and Jerry Herbison said he thought it was a Fisher, and Ernie Johnson said they probably discovered it at Ohio State. I put almost all of my patients on a pool exercise program. I think it's appropriate that we're here at Warm Springs, so I can testify to that. The first time I saw Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I was an 8-year-old child in Indianapolis, and they had built a ramp up to the pool at the Riley Children's Hospital, where I had my polio treatment in 1940, and his Ford was driven up to the place, and he looked in our pool and then drove down and drove away. The thing that impressed me the most, nothing personal about Mr. Roosevelt, but was the fact that they had a long line of cord cars, which was a magnificent looking car with superchargers, and my childhood memory is more of that and that interesting ramp than, and when Hugh gave his talk the other day, it reminded me of that. I believe in pool exercises, and I think it's a good medium for conditioning. It feels good to the patient, and if you heat up the pool a bit, as we do at the Kenney Institute up to 90 degrees, it really feels pretty comfortable even for anybody's aching body. I've done muscle re-education techniques primarily to test the concept that maybe people have stopped using muscles because they have stopped using muscles, and that the muscle has stopped functioning because it wasn't used rather than because it was wasting away. And the amazing thing is that a lot of muscles that had been functioning actually start working again. But I'm not making a deal of this. I think that it's something that can happen. It's an interesting phenomenon, and I think it makes me think that we should be cautious when we report the loss of muscle function, because sometimes the muscle is, as Dr. Mueller said in 1970, in every muscle unused for years and seemingly paralyzed slumbers hope for easy rehabilitation. And the interest, I'm glad I found that remark, because I was going to try to say it myself, but there's nothing like a German translated into English for turning a good phrase. Because the thing that I have found is that in the Cybex and the PREs and the muscle re-education, the effect is a muscle learning effect. It's a motor learning effect that happens. So I believe that the critical thing is relearning, or the muscle learning, or the de-learning effect, or under-training effect that we see in a lot of these patients. It's not the patient with the progressive poliomuscular atrophy that we're hearing about. But on the other hand, in our 126 patients that we've had in our clinic, we haven't seen one yet that we recognized. And that's a problem that I'm nervous about, because I think I might recognize it when our procedures fail. But I've brought out almost every technique of muscle re-education that was ever used, and all of them work. The powder board, I've run out of time. 30 seconds, okay.
I got a watch.
Okay. Let me just tell you that I believe in cardiopulmonary conditioning, and we have an exercise physiologist who sets a program based on the residual muscle function. We use an exercise bike. I like one that there must be a million companies that make them, but the Schwinn bike makes one that has the capability of alternating arm and leg function. So when my leg tires, I can use my arms. The arm ergometer, wheelchair roller, swimming and wheelchair sports are means of cardiopulmonary conditioning. I feel that the pain and the fatigue in some individuals with these progression of symptoms is associated with deconditioning. And I think we see it in our chronic pain patients, and they get better with conditioning and exercising. And I use that term, get better, reluctantly. Dr. Mueller and others who are more involved in anatomical physiologic measurements, but I report it only as such, and I'll have more data that will be subjected to better review. It's not that I'm trying to weasel out. It was that Laura got me to do this before we were ready with statistics. Okay, I should stop. Okay, I'll stop. I was going to say that anybody who wanted to sit next to me on the bus, if they found a misspelled word on my report, could win that right. Has anybody found that? What's that? Okay, well, it's right there. Follow up. I looked it up in our Oxford Dictionary, and I should have put a hyphen in it, and I noticed that Dr. Calford did a marvelous job on that. I apologize, and I hope that I didn't embarrass the state of Minnesota, my adopted state.
He's going to slip. I think that was an interruption that all of us appreciated.
I didn't mind his testimony.
In any event, I did want to offer Dick a few minutes. Again, we are pressed for time. There are a number of other people who are scheduled to speak this morning, but Dick raised a lot of interesting issues and wanted to have a few minutes for some exchange between Dr. Owen and the audience. So let's entertain some questions for a few minutes, please.
Feldman from Edmonton. I was delighted to hear what you had to say. The idea of management of these patients is one which is very dear to my heart, as you know, and while we don't follow quite the same protocol, certainly as we're starting off and trying to do something for these patients after evaluating them, the more we can emphasize management and appropriate management and do it together in a similar type of way so that we can then compare the results of what we're doing and see if we in fact do improve these patients and for how long a period of time with proper follow-up. I think that's the greatest thing that you brought out today, and I certainly agree that we should continue doing something like that.
May I? I don't want to finish my whole talk, but what Ruben brought up is a point that I do want to make, and that is that with this group of people we've already identified, we hope to have a group that we can follow prospectively now and follow in a careful clinical fashion from now on. Another aspect is that we hope to look at the individuals in wheelchair athletics, and that's not only in our own North Central region, but across the country. I know Ernie has contacts. And the other group is the group that Dr. Knapp will be searching out, hopefully with the help of Dr. Calfort and Dr. Codd, in some collaborative fashion.
Let me just make a fast comment. Perhaps we could do a collaborative type of thing. We're not that far away from each other. We have similar climatic conditions, and it sounds like similar patients. Mm-hmm. And maybe between you and us and people in Winnipeg and Saskatoon, for example, we could get something going, which would be very nice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dick, I'd like to ask a question. It seems like a lot of my patients are all overweight, and they always ask me, what should I weigh? And I'm always concerned, number one, I'm not sure what to tell them what they should weigh because of the obvious atrophy that many of them have, and whether or not you're finding that weight is a real issue in your population.
I don't think it's an issue any more than in the population that comes to my office with other health problems. And I was interested in that because I had speculated that it would be. I think excessive weight makes a neuromotor disease more disabling. But and therefore, I would have expected to see more people pouring in. But on the other hand, that again might be something that they're shy about because people are into self-management nowadays and feeling responsible for themselves. But I have no...
Joe Crawford from Manitoba. I, in relationship to the last statement that you just made about self-management and also David Roosevelt's comment on the president's own late involvement in exercise kinds of programming. One of the things I'm finding in doing these sort of in-depth follow-ups of a selected subsample is that current involvement in medically directed or self-directed exercise programs is seen as very analogous to the self-help and heavy individual responsibility that people felt and feeling of efficacy that they had in the first 2 or 3 years of rehab or for a longer period of time. And I think it's a real dilemma for us today in terms of the potential debate about exercise, but I think there's also the psychosocial side of the efficacy of doing something actively and people's memory of that during the early post-rehab as something that they could do for themselves. And it's true for the families as well as the individuals. Mm-hmm. And your program seems to relate to that need and that memory of past exercise experience.
Thank you.
Johnson, Columbus. About the weight, I think most people with neuromuscular disease overestimate what their normal weight would be.
Oh, I agree.
I tell them that if they're a female, 42% of their body should be skeletal muscle, and we then calculate what weight there is. And from Beasley's work, which is the number of motor units or muscle left per grade, you see, and you can very easily estimate that maybe 3/4 of the muscle is gone, ergo they should be considerably less.
Thank you.
I'm stuck over here in the corner. We'll move over in just a second.
McKinstry, Warm Springs. Dr. Bosmer, John Hopkins Swallowing Center's director, asked me to ask this conference. He's having an influx of polio patients with swallowing problems and dysphagia. Are you seeing those problems? And does anybody else want to comment about it?
Well, I thought Jerry was holding up his hand. He's just holding up his camera. You can hold up your camera.
I did have a...
No, but
I want to answer the question, please. There's a question before the floor.
I bow to your answering the question.
Okay. Yes. We've seen three people, and it's a dilemma. We've had our speech pathologists see them, and all of these people were people with bulbar palsy. I was interested in Armin, or a comment that somebody made after Armin Fischer's talk about the use of glossopharyngeal breathing for as a conditioning exercise. I'm certainly looking forward to making use of that in that group, because it just seems to me that it may be that we might have a mechanism. But I think it's a terrifying problem, and I have no solution.
Maynard, Ann Arbor. I had a question, Dr. Owens. You mentioned that 57 of your patients were referred to physical therapy for our program. And my question
was... Those were of the...
Of the 120, some.
Of the 126 I've seen. I've only had 36 patients in my polio clinic through the protocol.
I see. Well, what I was getting around to was I was wondering why, when you talk about the exercise protocols, some of these, of course, are sound like a good sort of health habits, so to speak, in terms of stretching in the back. They're prophylactic measures, so to speak. My question is, how many are you really putting on specific strengthening programs for a purpose? For a functional purpose. In other words, you're trying to strengthen a particular muscle because the person is no longer able to do something more analogous to what I think I heard Dr. Feldman saying the other day. And at the same time, I heard you say some of the people you were advising them to use wheelchairs or additional bracing or crutches, which is sort of the implication that you're not able to achieve the strengthening and another way around it. Not that they're incompatible all the time, but I wondered what the relative frequency of that was. And then lastly, what about the pain issue? Are you seeing pain issues in that, and does that affect those other two questions about exercise?
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on side two.